The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. Hello everyone, welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine with me, Chris Hasler. And this week we're going to look back on some of our old episodes or some of the material from our old episodes. And our focus is going to be on some great journeys of history. So I've picked out four great journeys, and of course one of the most obvious great journeys of ancient history has to be the one of Hannibal Barca of the Carthaginians. Hannibal's great journey was his daring invasion of Italy during the Second Punic War, where he led his Carthaginian army, which included war elephants from Spain, across the Pyrenees, the Rhone River and the Alps, overcoming many obstacles and enemies along the way. Hannibal's great journey was one of the most remarkable feats of military strategy and endurance in ancient warfare. Hannibal would set about gathering an army. The size of the army is argued, and I have seen numbers from 40,000 to 100,000 offered. Strangely, when investigating the number of elephants in Hannibal's army, we seem to always hit the specific number of 37 from most sources. The makeup of the Carthaginian army is also interesting. Libyan foot soldiers are mentioned, and when we look at the Libyans, they may have been a mixture of local Berbers and Greek immigrants to North Africa, as it was in the Libyan lands that the Greek colony of Cyrene was established. Also among the Carthaginian army were Numidian horsemen. The Numidians were the Berbers who lived on the North African coast of the modern-day country of Algeria, and as such, they had developed strong diplomatic ties with their Carthaginian neighbours. There would have almost certainly been a good deal of Celtiberian mercenaries wanting to be on the winning side and believing that this would be Hannibal's Carthaginians. Despite the problem from the Carthaginian perspective being Roman interference in politics south of the river Ebro, Hannibal would lead his Carthaginian army of tens of thousands north over the river Ebro and into forbidden lands on their way toward the modern lands of Italy. The route would require the Carthaginians to negotiate the Pyrenees Mountains, the lands of the Gauls, and the Alps Mountains. Crossing the Alps would have been seemingly impossible, with it being such a severe range of mountains. The legend of Hannibal crossing the Alps is the lasting legacy of this episode in history. But in reality, it was only part of this whole journey of attrition, which was made in haste before the Romans could attack first. Not everybody survived the journey. Significant losses affected the Carthaginian force as they initially crossed the Pyrenees and arrived in the lands of the south of the modern-day country of France. So the famous story is of Hannibal crossing the Alps, but this is just one part of an extremely arduous journey from the Iberian lands south of the Ebro to the imperial lands of the Roman Republic. at every juncture, whether it be the lands around the Pyrenees or the Gallic lands of southern France, Hannibal's army would face attack from local tribes, and so Hannibal would spend significant time reshaping his army, even sending some units back to Carthaginian Iberia. It wasn't all against Hannibal though, as there would have been a fair share of tribes who were happy to support Hannibal's campaign, especially if they felt no loyalty to the Romans. So Hannibal would have not had much idea as to whether the next society of people that he encountered would have been friend or foe. The next geographical obstacle that Hannibal would have needed to negotiate would have been the Rhone River. There, Hannibal would encounter Celtic tribes supportive of the Romans near the coastal Greek colony city of Massalia, which is the modern French city of Marseille. The Celts were more specifically the Volci, who were a Gallic entity who had been involved in Greek affairs earlier in the century and were now being commissioned by the Romans to prevent the progress of Hannibal. The Rhone River was a considerable crossing, and with the Volci actively trying to prevent the crossing, it raises the question, what about the famous elephants? Did Hannibal have to find a way to transport the elephants over the river, or were the elephants transported to the eastern side of the Rhone by sea? Livy says that some of the elephants fell into the Rhone and had to swim to safety. Either way, Hannibal was victorious over the Volci at the Battle of the Rhone Crossing, showing a canny tactical approach that outwitted his opponents. With the Rhone River behind him, Hannibal pressed onwards towards the Alps. Already Hannibal had lost a large amount of his army, but somehow during this hard journey, which was only going to get harder, Hannibal managed to keep the remainder of his army motivated to continue. Hannibal's Alpine route is fiercely debated, but we know that the Alps had to be navigated across. The journey through the Alps is something that has become mythologized, capturing the imagination of many artists who've created dramatic depictions of armies accompanied by elephants attempting to march along improbable mountain passes perilously close to a deadly fall over the edge. In reality, this crossing would have been treacherous to say the least, with icy cold conditions and slippery surfaces. Despite being younger than 30 years old at the time, Hannibal must have been a trusted leader and a man promising the rewards that should accompany a conquest of the Roman Republic. The procession continued despite the fact that it was apparent that not everybody would survive. Reports suggest that Hannibal's army had to actually rebuild some of the pass that had fallen into a state of damage. Another Gallic tribe called the Allobroges would have attacked the weakened and hungry Carthaginians during the crossing, but somehow Hannibal was able to overcome this. When Hannibal emerged on the eastern side of the Alps with a fraction of his original army, but according to some accounts with the same 37 elephants, some of the Gallic tribes felt that Hannibal was worth their respect and even worth standing alongside in the face of the Romans. It was now December of 218 BCE, and Hannibal was successfully across the Alps and at the north of the Italian peninsula. It could be fair to say that the Romans were not expecting Hannibal to emerge from his Alpine journey in any position to fight, but the Romans would know that they needed to deal with the Hannibal problem directly and sent a force under the command of the Roman consul, Tiberius Sempronius Longus, to engage Hannibal in a battle at the confluence of the Trebia and Po rivers. The ensuing battle is known as the Battle of the Trebia, and the Roman naivety and underestimation of Hannibal allowed Hannibal to outwit the Romans and score a huge victory, with more than half of the Roman army being lost to the Carthaginian alliance. Hannibal now had the Romans' full attention. So this is the story of how Hannibal crossed the Alps, but Hannibal's intention when he set out wasn't to successfully cross the Alps in some test of endurance. The crossing was simply one part of a mission to invade and weaken the Roman Republic. So Hannibal had only just begun. There was no way that Hannibal could cause significant problems for the Romans without enticing local societies to join his cause, and he would have been relying on this fact. Hannibal's victories in the north of the peninsula, such as the Battle of the Trebia, opened up a doorway into the lands of the Republic itself. Hannibal could now campaign directly towards Rome itself, but initially he would need to negotiate the lands of Etruria, which were inhabited by Romanized Etruscans. So Hannibal would lead his army southwards until almost reaching Lake Trasimene in the summer of 217 BCE. The Roman army would be pursuing Hannibal, and Hannibal would be aware of this. So upon reaching the lake, Hannibal would light false campfires some distance away to fool the Romans into believing the location of the Carthaginian army was somewhere it wasn't. It was a trap, and in the misty conditions, as the Romans made their way along the northern edge of the lake, the Carthaginians appeared from the forests and ambushed their enemy. The Roman army was estimated to be about 30,000 strong, so it is quite a considerable thing that it was ambushed. It took almost 4 hours for the Carthaginians to destroy the Roman army, with their commander, the consul Gaius Flaminius, losing his own life in the process. The remaining Romans retreated, and Carthaginians, under the command of Hannibal, were now scoring victories well within Roman territory. This was unthinkable just a couple of years earlier. Hannibal could have attacked Rome following his victory at Lake Trasimene, but instead he decided to rally up more willing allies from within the lands of the Roman Republic. So Hannibal headed south towards the lands of Magna Graecia, and the Romans stayed in hot pursuit. They did not want to give Hannibal any kind of opportunity to be able to settle anywhere within the Republic. Should Hannibal be allowed to settle, he may have created a power base in which he could start recruiting societies who believed that defecting to Hannibal would be advantageous, considering how formidable he appeared to be. The Romans frantically built up a brand new army force in order to take on the Carthaginians, and in 216 BCE, the two sides met again at Cannae. What happened at Cannae in the year 216 BCE would go down as the single most deadliest day in the history of European lands. Hannibal managed to sustain an army strength of around 50,000, but estimates of a Roman army number are thought to have been in excess of 85,000. The Romans had had enough of the Carthaginians and had decided to put an end to this problem once and for all. The Roman army was led by the two Roman consuls, Gaius Terentius Varro and Lucius Aemilius Paullus. What followed was one of the most astonishing days of the entire first millennium BCE. The huge Roman army attacked the Carthaginians. Once again, Hannibal demonstrated that he was a master tactician equal to the threat of the Romans. You could argue that Hannibal's tactical expertise was worth thousands of soldiers on its own. Hannibal's Carthaginian army, still made up from various ethnicities, would entice the Roman infantry to act down the centre of the army formations. When Hannibal would use his cavalry to push the Roman cavalry back into an ineffective position so that the Roman infantry could be surrounded and brutally massacred. Estimates of over 45,000 Roman soldiers were killed. Hannibal would have undoubtedly have made his father, Hamilcar Barca, incredibly proud. Hamilcar had always been defiant of the Romans and was too stubborn to negotiate the peace terms after the Carthaginian defeat at the end of the First Punic War. Now his own son had marched into Roman territory and given them a taste of their own medicine. And thanks to these amazing victories against the odds, Hannibal could now consider conquering the entire Roman Republic. Roman cities and provinces started defecting to Carthage, meaning that now Carthage had influence over a significant amount of territory on the Italian peninsula itself, including the very important city of Capua. Hannibal was now in a position to be considerate about his next action within these relatively safe lands. One of the more attractive targets for Hannibal's ambitions was the port city of Tarentum, which once was an enemy of Rome, but now a loyal ally. While Hannibal was trying to secure these cities in the southern extremities of the Italian peninsula, the Romans saw an opportunity to target the city of Capua in Campania, laying it under siege. They were punishing the city for siding with the enemy after demanding that one of the Roman consuls be a Capua resident. Our next great journey discusses the Chinese explorer and diplomat called Zhang Chen, who lived in the 2nd century BCE. He was sent by Emperor Wu of the Han Dynasty to establish contact with the Yuji people who lived in Central Asia. Consequently, he was the first Chinese man to explore the unknown regions of China, of Central Asia and beyond. He was the pioneer of the Silk Road that facilitated the exchange of goods, ideas and cultures between East and West. Emperor Wu succeeded his father, Emperor Jing, in the year 141 BCE, and things would change significantly during his reign. Emperor Wu was tired of sitting by as Han China took a very passive and diplomatic approach to its Xiongnu adversaries to the north, and decided that a more aggressive stance was needed in order to send a clear message to the Xiongnu that Han China was not willing to be subject to their threats and demands any longer. The Xiongnu had a difficult relationship with their steppe neighbours to the west, called the Yuezhi, who were being pushed further westwards by the expansions of the Xiongnu. Emperor Wu saw an opportunity to make a military pact with the Yuezhi against the Xiongnu, and so he sent one of his trusted military officers to discuss a relationship, and his name was Zhang Qian. Zhang Qian was captured while attempting to cross the territory of the Xiongnu to reach the Yuezhi, but they spared his life despite imprisoning him for many years. This did nothing to aid the Han Chinese cause, but Zhang Qian's story is a significant one, and one that we will talk of again. Emperor Wu would appeal to his more influential subjects in order to rally them to his cause against the Xiongnu by telling them that the power of the Xiongnu was causing financial hardship to Han China and that conflict was necessary. So in 133 BCE, Emperor Wu would plan to ambush the Xiongnu led by Junchen Chanyu at the Battle of Ma Yi, but the plan failed. the Xiongnu would quickly realize Emperor Wu's aggressive intentions and realize that they were now officially at war. Emperor Wu understood what Qin Shi Huang of Qin China and Mao Dun Chanyu of the Xiongnu had understood in the past, and that is that by expanding your territory well, you can add wealth and power to your empire. So Emperor Wu would stretch Han Chinese territory southwards to the South China Sea coast and the northern lands of the modern country of Vietnam. He would also stretch his territory to the brink of the Korean Peninsula. This would aid Emperor Wu in succeeding in campaigns against the Xiongnu and taking territories north of the Yellow River, around the Gobi Desert, and westwards into the strategically important Hexi Corridor, which is a gateway to the deeper lands of Inner Asia. Finally, Han China was turning the balance of power in their direction. In terms of how Emperor Wu governed Han China, he would promote Confucianism as the state philosophy and set up academies that would train up Confucian scholars that could be given political positions. Although aspects of the legalist system of the Qin dynasty survived and remained a foundation of the Han dynasty, legalism as a state philosophy was now finished, and Confucianism dominated Chinese history, although aspects of legalism have survived also. So all of these early philosophies of China, Confucianism, Taoism and legalism are underpinning influences on Chinese societies throughout Chinese history. Scholars in Han China would face a final civil service examination to assess their suitability for high office, and this appeared to be a positive step. Now, you will recall that at the start of the story of Emperor Wu's tensions with the Xiongnu, that they captured the Han envoy called Zhang Qian, and that he was incarcerated for many years. Somehow he was able to escape this imprisonment and dutifully did visit the Yueqi, an enemy of the Xiongnu, to seek the military alliance that was his mission originally to achieve. But he was too late though. The Yueqi had settled lands in and around the modern country of Tajikistan and had no necessity to strike up a military alliance, as tensions between them and the Xiongnu had died down. Zhang Qian decided to remain in Yueqi territory before returning back to Han China in 125 BCE without an alliance, but with plenty of information about foreign lands and exotic goods unknown to the Chinese. Zhang Qian had seen and heard enough to believe in the value of a second mission to the lands of the West. This time it would be a reconnaissance mission. When Zhang Qian returned again, he would bring a wealth of information about the complex societies of the West, such as the Greco-Bactrians, the Parthians, and the Seleucids. The significance of this being that they were learning of some very permanent imperial societies that were equivalent to Han China, and may have just been the stuff of fantasy to the minds of the Han Chinese previously. The exotic plants, foods and produce of these lands would be very attractive to the Han Chinese, in the same way that their own produce would have been attractively exotic to the Eurasian and South Asian societies. So a merchant network along a trade route suddenly became very busy thanks to this new knowledge, and this would be famously referred to as the Silk Road, due to the fact that silk itself was the most popular demand of the ever-expanding Romans, who were now having an influence over the Asiatic lands of the Mediterranean Sea for the first time. We will explore the Silk Road phenomenon in greater detail in a few episodes' time, but needless to say that these new relationships were creating new mercantile interaction that had been hopelessly suppressed by the Qin dynasty in the previous century. It was only helping the Han dynasty to acquire more wealth, meaning that the Xiongnu were now reduced to second place in their ongoing conflicts. We have found it difficult to date the periplus of the Erythraean Sea, but some historians have suggested of a date around the 1st century. And if we look at the links from the Chinese perspective, then there is none better than the man called Zheng Tian, who we first mentioned back in episode 67. He was alive way back in the 2nd century BCE, and he was sent by Emperor Wu of Han as an envoy to travel to the lands of the Yueji and negotiate a political alliance with the traditional enemy of the Han, the Xiongnu. The Xiongnu captured Zheng Qian and imprisoned him for at least a decade before he was able to escape and reach the Yueji. By the time he reached the Yueji, the political feelings had altered and the Yueji had become comfortable with their lifestyle and disinterested in the ongoing matters between the Han and the Xiongnu. It would have been a fruitless journey, but it may be that Zheng Tian discovered the reason for the Yueji's comfortable attitude. Perhaps it was that the Yueji were enjoying trade links with the lands now directly to their own west and were no longer dependent on the east. And so Zheng Tian appealed to the Chinese emperor to allow him to continue to gather information on these relatively unknown societies of the west. The Chinese emperor approved, and Zheng Tian would bring back knowledge of the Greek-influenced societies of Bactria, the Parthians, and the cultures of the Indian subcontinent, and he would bring that knowledge back to Han China. After this point, we can see considerable efforts throughout the 1st century BCE by Han China and their rivals the Xiongnu to establish control of the traversable land route from China to the west. And this was obviously because societies quickly recognise the opportunities that lie beyond them and how those opportunities could bolster the economy of your respective nation and elevate your power above that of your enemy. After Zheng Qian's death, we have the records of a living Chinese historian to refer to regarding early information about the West. His name is Sima Qian, and he describes the Parthians as a peoples who lived beyond the lands of the Yueji. Sima Qian described them as fully sedentary people living in various cities, and those cities numbered into the hundreds. He describes how the people used the lands to cultivate crops, which would not have been unusual. However, he does describe a ruler of the lands who gives orders to local chiefs, and it would make sense that this ruler would have been the long-serving king of the Parthians, Mithridates II. The reign of King Mithridates was one of the most iconic reigns in Persian history, and it is largely because of the activity of other nations and empires of the time. The Armenians were at their most powerful under the rule of King Tigranes the Great, and we spoke of this period back in episode 3. The Seleucids at this time were experiencing a steep decline, and this is because they were trapped between three mighty and expanding empires. These empires were the Parthians under the rule of Mithridates II, the Armenians under the rule of Tigranes II, and the Roman Republic, who by this time had recently gained control of the Balkan Peninsula and were looking to establish their imperial rule over the Asiatic lands of Asia Minor. So by focusing on the Parthian king Mithridates II, we have considerable reference to a diplomatic link from him to the Han Empire and a political situation which required him to have diplomatic links to the Roman Empire. And therefore, we can see how these two very iconic endpoints of the Silk Road began to gain knowledge of each other, and why we can see that knowledge of a Chinese society in Roman scriptures dating to the early years of the Roman Empire, as referenced in the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. Next up, we look at the great journey of the Varangians. Now, the Varangians were Vikings who travelled from Scandinavia to the lands of Eastern Europe and Byzantium. They were traders, warriors, and settlers who had a significant impact on the history and culture of these regions. And they were also the ancestors of many noble and royal families in Europe and Asia. The story of the Kievan Rus is the story of a migration of peoples, probably of Scandinavian origin, settling the lands in and around the modern city of Kyiv in Ukraine. But of course, there was activity in this area before the arrival of the Scandinavian migrants. And so it would be correct for us to discuss exactly what was going on there. You may recall that when we originally spoke of the Scythians, we always have to be very careful to state exactly what we are referring to. The Scythians were a group of tribal nomads who occupied the Pontic Caspian steppe in the times of classical antiquity. But the term Scythian can also refer to a wider culture of peoples who occupied Eurasian steppe lands throughout the first millennium BCE. One group of peoples who lived to the west of the Scythian tribes, but who are referred to as being linked to Scythian culture, are the Cimmerians, who occupied lands in and around the Dnieper River. The Cimmerians and the Scythians are recorded as aggressors towards the northern frontiers of the Assyrian Empire during the first half of the first millennium BCE, which didn't do the Assyrians any favours when it came to defending their territory against the advances of the Medes and the Babylonians. The Cimmerians disappear from history around the middle of the first millennium BCE, but the Scythian peoples remained as apparent as ever, possibly displacing the Cimmerians around the lands of the Dnieper. The Scythians would then develop their culture in the lands to the north of the Black Sea and start to create settlements and diplomatic relations with their neighbours such as the ancient Greeks. Scythians would travel to Greece in order to receive education and to work, in order to take the benefits back to their own society. But they would become a target of the Macedonians under their king Philip II. It's possible that this turn of events in Greece served to isolate the Scythians, and we find that records of them become sparse, and we can consider their heyday had been and gone. We find that these lands became interesting to a number of migrants over the following centuries. The Sarmatians were another steppe culture of Iranian stock who settled the lands of the modern country of Ukraine towards the end of the first millennium BCE, and they can be considered as among the many barbarian tribes of the Romans. Their lands were pressurized by the migration of Goths, a Germanic peoples from northern Europe, to the banks of the Black Sea during the years of the Roman Empire. When the Huns migrated westwards into Sarmatian lands, the Sarmatians found themselves sandwiched and then assimilated into Hunnic-ruled territory. The Huns continued their movement westwards into the middle of Europe, where they would do battle with the Romans. By the end of the 5th century, the Huns lost their power and influence and disappeared somewhat into obscurity, leaving the former Scythian lands without a firm political identity. Now, if we go right back to the start again and speak of the Scythian cultures, we are talking primarily about the cultures who lived around the lower Dnieper River valley and the lands to the east and west of this, on the northern banks of the Black Sea. The Dnieper River empties into the Black Sea, and as we travel upriver, we would today encounter the Ukrainian capital city of Kyiv, before travelling onwards to the modern country of Belarus. And linguists who give great credence to the Proto-Indo-European language theory, which we studied back in Volume 2, suggest that we can point to this area of the Upper Dnieper River as an area where we would discover some of the earliest Slavic language speakers. The Vistula River is just to the west of the Dnieper River, but it flows northwards into the Baltic Sea. Roman documents help us to identify this area as the origin of the Goths before their migration southwards to the banks of the Black Sea. But if we go beyond the Vistula, then the Romans spoke of a peoples called the Veneti, who were culturally and linguistically distinct from the Germanic Goths and the Sarmatians. Historians of a later time suggest that the Veneti were early Slavs.
Slavs.
We haven't really given the Slavs a lot of attention during this podcast series, but now is a good time to try to tie some loose ends together and describe these people of hazy origin that have become a major part of European ethnicity. Linguistic studies can often give us pointers to origins and migrations of peoples where archaeological or historical records are absent. Slavic language speakers have been determined to be part of the Indo-European language groups and a part of the Balto-Slavic language branch. Baltic languages such as Lithuanian and Latvian diverged from Slavic languages, leaving Slavic languages to develop independently. Our first historical references to Slavic speakers come from Roman sources, such as when they reference the Veneti, as mentioned previously. And it appears that they were able to exploit a vacated area of lands created by the westward migration of the Huns into Central Europe, which also forced Germanic tribes westward out of the lands of the Dnieper and Dniester rivers, which had been previously occupied by the Goths. In the wake of the Hunnic era, the Byzantine Empire established its own identity, and Byzantine scribes recognised Slavic speakers occupying lands to their north. Slavic speakers appear to have diverged into three distinct groups, leading into the 7th century, where distinctions appear to be recognised by neighbouring European peoples. Germanic speakers of Central Europe recognised a migration of peoples into the eastern lands of the modern country of Germany, who were referred to as the Wends, and have since been distinguished as the West Slavs and the ancestors to the modern Poles, Czechs and Slovaks. The Byzantines recognised two other ethnic groups who have come to be linguistically linked to the Wends. One group were the Sclaveni, who were recognised during the era of the Emperor Justinian, who may have been forced southwards onto the northern frontiers of the Byzantine Empire by the westward migrations of the Avars, Bulgars and Magyars during the later half of the first millennium. These peoples have been distinguished as the South Slavs, and they were ancestral to many of today's former Yugoslavian states and to the Bulgarians. The remaining Slavic speakers, who were not forced deeper into European territories, are the ones who interest us today, and they were recognised as the Antes people by the Byzantines and have since been distinguished as the East Slavs and are ancestral to today's Russians, Ukrainians and Belarusians. These East Slavs are believed to have existed in these areas between the lands of the Upper Vistula and the Upper Dnieper for many centuries before the supposed migrations of Scandinavians from the north, as it is speculated by historians that they interacted with all of the cultures passing through and around this area during the entire first millennium, including the Scythians, the Sarmatians, Greek-speaking Romans, the Goths and the Huns.
Varangians.
It seems possible that Scandinavians with the typical Viking mentality travelled eastwards into the extremities of the Baltic Sea and migrated southwards along the lands and rivers of Eastern Europe and Western Russia. The opportunities of the lands must have been very attractive to these Viking raiders, who were quickly able to make contact with the large empires of the Romans and the Arabs to the south of the Black Sea. And this was during the first half of the 9th century. The lands between Lake Ladoga in the north and the Black Sea in the south were occupied generally by East Slavs, and the Vikings who encountered them seemed to take the upper hand. This may be because the Viking nature was to terrorize and steal from others more readily than the agricultural Slavs, who were familiar with creating their own resource from the land as opposed to taking the resources of others. We have discovered that the Vikings were not the medieval Neanderthals that some are attracted into making them out to be. They were familiar with their neighbours and how to negotiate with them for their own benefit, and even though they may not have been as sedentary and self-sufficient as other European cultures, they were certainly very capable of trade and diplomacy with whomever they encountered. The Slavs were just unfortunately a simple group of tribes who were not centrally governed, and this enabled the Vikings to plunder without consequence and capture small populations for onward trade as slaves. It is absolutely no coincidence that the words Slav and slave are almost the same. This is exactly where the word slave derives from. Such was the impact of what the Vikings did to them, and how societies such as the Byzantines benefited from these exchanges. As well as slaves, these Vikings appear to have traded in furs captured from animals from the forests of the north and traded for the coins of the Arabs of the south, as discovered in grave sites all the way back in Sweden. The Vikings referenced in Eastern scripts are specifically referred to as the Swedes, which distinguishes them from the Norwegians and the Danes that we are familiar with seeing in Western European references to the Vikings. It is important to remain open-minded when reading historical sources, and particularly those written in the generations following the events, due to the fact that they may seek to embellish events to shine a positive light on a particular ethnicity. Indiscretions between one source and another can cast a shadow of doubt on some of what we are reading, so it can be complacent to regard anything as canon. The primary chronicle is a history of the people called the Rus and was written in the 12th century. Some of its detail differs from that of other sources, such as those written about the Rus by the Byzantines, so we have to proceed with a lot of caution. The primary chronicle tells us that the East Slav tribes approached Swedish Vikings and requested that the Swedes become their overlords in order to prevent further infighting between East Slav and Finn tribes who occupied the lands in question. Personally, I find this hard to process, but it is what is written nonetheless. The man who stepped forward to be the first ruler was called Rurik of Ladoga, and he ruled over these peoples and established his power base at the city of Novgorod, which is now Veliki Novgorod in northwest Russia and stands on the Volkhov River, which empties into Lake Ladoga. We also mentioned the Finns, and these were people who may have occupied lands around the Volga River, and they are ancestral of the modern Finnish and Estonian peoples and may likely share a distant ancestral link with Hungarians as recognised by linguists. The Byzantines named these peoples of Viking origin the Varangians. These Varangians very quickly started to establish trade routes between the Byzantines and the Muslims in the south, with the Baltic waterways of the north, creating a highly significant and effective movement of goods during the 9th century that was better than the alternative and rather more complicated route via the great density of powers that were struggling to establish their respective statuses and relationships with each other in Central Europe. The descendants of Rurik are known as the Rurikids, and they would become the royal ruling dynasty of many subsequent nation-states of this geographical area, right up until the 17th century and the Tsardom of Russia, and the state that took its name from the Rus. The story of the legend of Rurik offering to be the saviour of the Slavic tribes can come across as a bit far-fetched, so the alternative historian view is that the Varangians simply established their own area of rule in the Eurasian steppe and may have referred to it as a Khaganate, which is a Turkic term somewhat equivalent to a kingdom or an empire. The Rus' relationship with Constantinople was not smooth, with records of Rus raids and sieges on the city by and large unsuccessful. Certainly one attack was conducted by the successor of Rurik, whose name was Alek, and it appears that it would be Alek who would expand the Rus realm to incorporate lands further south and including the city of Kiev on the Dnieper River, which allowed ease of access to the Black Sea and the fruitful trading opportunities associated with it. We can view this as the beginning of the state called the Kievan Rus. This is likely to have happened in the second half of the 9th century, although there are discrepancies between all of the sources available which can cause us to question the exact details. According to legend, the city of Kiev was established by three East Slavic brothers in the early medieval period, although archaeology suggests a much older settlement. The conquest of Kiev really set things up for the future. The people developed a new national identity based on this foundation, which we can suggest to be the origins of the Russian peoples, as well as the Belarusians and also the Ukrainians, who find their modern capital city at Kiev. The onset of agriculture took over from the much more mobile lifestyles of the Vikings, but the trade network only became wealthier and more widespread as the Kievan Rus linked the Arab and Turkic caliphates and Khaganates and the Byzantine Empire with the emerging Scandinavian kingdoms of the north. The term Varangian was given to the Norse people by the Byzantines. Before the Christianization and introduction of Latin to the Norse realms, runic scripts were used that were based on alphabetic principles as opposed to syllabic, but were common to Germanic language speakers before Latinization. We can find many inscribed runestones concentrated in the lands of the modern country of Sweden that tell us of voyages from the Baltic to a mysterious land called Gardariki, which has since been determined by some to actually be the Rus state. From their new capital city at Kiev, the Kievan Rus established a wealthy state based on an extensive trade network reaching out to the lucrative Muslim cities of Baghdad and Alexandria. And our final dive back into the history of the world podcast will be to explore the People's Crusade, which was a popular movement of mostly untrained and poor crusaders who set off for the Holy Land in 1096 before the official start of the First Crusade. They were led by the charismatic preacher named Peter the Hermit, who claimed to have a letter from God instructing him to liberate Jerusalem from the Muslims. The Pope at the time was Urban II. Urban did not have a harmonious relationship with the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry IV, who tried to install an anti-pope. So Urban may have been encouraged to appeal to other Christian nations in order to create a bonding relationship, and the excuse to support the Byzantines
could have been just what he needed. Urban travelled to Aquitaine, where he would call a council of clergymen at Clermont in November 1095. He appealed to the clergy to offer support to the Byzantines, stating that Muslim peoples were taking the lands of Christian peoples, stating that they had committed murder and destroyed churches. He would urge the clergymen at Clermont to spread a message far and wide to all classes of people to offer their service in the defence of Christendom, which was slowly being captured by Muslims. Urban would portray the Turks as savage in their behaviour, and that they would stop at nothing to maltreat Christian people, property and churches. Urban would call on the Christians of Western Europe to unite in the cause of their Eastern cousins and to eradicate the Muslim hold over the Holy Land and the city of Jerusalem. So, from the appeal of Alexios to the Pope, Pope Urban had turned this into an opportunity to invade the Holy Land. The invasion would be in the form of a pilgrimage, in the same way that many great Christians had made the pilgrimage to Jerusalem in the centuries gone by. But this pilgrimage was to be conducted with a military aspect. The clergy at Clermont rallied behind Pope Urban II by exclaiming, "Dieu le voit," translated to "God wills it." One particular priest called Peter of Amiens was inspired by the words of Pope Urban II, but we're not entirely sure whether he attended the Council of Clermont. We do know that he travelled around Western Europe, rallying up anyone who might be interested in taking part in a military pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and many peasants and low-ranking knights answered the call. By the springtime of the following year, thousands and thousands had congregated with the intention of travelling to Asia. Peter of Amiens is more popularly known as Peter the Hermit, and he would be at the head of the pilgrimage. The story of this particular pilgrimage, known to history as the People's Crusade, doesn't read very well. A peasant army in search of wealth and fortune and absolution of personal sins set off for Asia and crossed through the Rhineland, where they would massacre thousands of Jews. Also,
hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Seen as the enemy of Christians for the purpose of this venture. It may have been that members of the Crusade may have seen the massacre of Jews as a means to steal their wealth and fund their adventure. Things did not improve for the People's Crusaders. They continued east across Hungarian lands into the Byzantine Empire's territories, where they started pillaging in order to continue their quest. Despite the tensions between the Crusaders and the Byzantine governor's troops near the city of Belgrade, the Crusaders reached Constantinople, where their transport across the Bosphorus Strait would be facilitated by Emperor Alexios. The People's Crusaders were not best equipped to combat the Seljuk Turks, even though they had an unwavering belief that they could attack and defeat the Seljuks. They ended up besieged at a castle near Nicaea, where they were starved out and forcibly converted to Islam or slaughtered. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast magazine, where we explored some of history's great journeys. Now, if you enjoy the podcast and if you want to support the podcast, please visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com, click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. When you do so, you will become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you will qualify for gifts and rewards. And if you want to get in touch with me here at the podcast, then please do drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com.
Listener messages and reviews.
A few to get through this week, which has been a rare thing of late. I would like to thank and welcome into the History of the World podcast Illuminati, Nicola Harvey. Thank you, Nicola, and welcome into our elite group. A little bit more about the Illuminati shortly. But some of the listener messages from Shannon. I've got a message saying, "Hello, Chris. Shannon from New Zealand here. Don't know if I'm messaging in the right place. Hope it's okay. Love everything about history. Picked up the podcast about a month and a half ago. Binged up until the start of the Roman Empire now. Just wanted to let you know that there are a few episodes near the end of the Republic and now that have around 5 to 10 minutes of dead air at the end of them. Listening on Spotify, if that helps, other than that, podcast is awesome. I'll probably be caught up in a month. I work 12 to 15 hour days. Well, goodness me, that's long. And this podcast definitely helps me through them. I probably listen to around 10 episodes a day at the moment. That's incredible. 10 episodes a day. Amazing. Well, thank you, Shannon. And wow, I wonder what you're doing. 12 to 15 hour days. That's a long day. That's a long day's work. But anyway, I wasn't aware that there was some episodes with dead air in them. And I'd be very interested from you, Shannon, or anyone else, if you could let me know which ones they are, so that I can look into eliminating that bit of dead air. I certainly wasn't aware that that was the case. But thank you, Shannon. Very kind of you to point that out. Not everyone says anything, do they? So it's very good. There was a review on Podbean, but I don't know who from. It just says, "Great podcast from a wonderful storyteller." So much gratitude towards you for that one. Martin Laird has emailed in saying, "Hi, Chris, love the podcast. Thanks so much for all your time and effort. Just checking, I've been a Patreon member since May 23, but I'm still not in the Illuminati on the website. Not worried about it per se, but just wanted to check that the money is reaching you. Let me know. If not, we'd better figure it out. Want you to be able to keep up the good work. Thanks again, Martin Laird, Sydney, Australia." Thank you, Martin. Well, yes, I did a refresh of that page. It was quite old and in need of a good update. And I see that your name is now there. So clearly that the contributions that you're making towards the project are making it and are certainly being well preserved and spent, I can assure you. So thank you very much, Martin. Really appreciate everything that you're doing for the podcast. Very, very grateful. And then also got an email from David, or Davide, who's put, "Hi, mate. I like your podcast and I'd like to sponsor you by requesting specific history episodes by money. If interested, let me know. See ya." Well, David or Davide, I would be pleased to tell you how you can do that. So many people have commissioned their own episodes. The current criteria is viewable at the Patreon website. And if you go to the Patreon website, I do something a little bit different to other Patreon web page creators. And that is that I do milestones. So that means that I don't commit people to donating $50 a month if they want to commission their own episode, for example. All I ask is that you reach the milestone over any length of time. So if you want a gift pack, you don't have to do $50 a month. You only have to donate $50 over any length of time. So so I invite you to sort of accrue these rewards in your own time. The special episode threshold is $300. So all patrons who donate $300 over any length of time can commission a podcast episode of their own choice. Back at the start, back in the day, it was $100. But I found that so many people were hitting that threshold that it made it too much of a distraction from the main narrative of the podcast. So unfortunately, I had to extend the threshold or the milestone to $300. But yeah, of course, it's absolutely still open to anyone. And as with any of the rewards, you only have to accrue the relevant amount of money over any amount of time. So go and sign up today and support your favourite podcast. We did get also one review, I think, on Apple Podcasts from Canada, if I'm not mistaken, from Och Laddie, who's put 5 stars, ambitious scope and delivers. I'm about 30 episodes in, like many podcasts. Professionalism increases with time. Presenter may be a layperson, but deserves a shout out for the obvious time and energy he puts into this. Incredibly sweeping scope, yet Chris keeps it focused, and other lay people like me are able to access this in bite-sized chunks. Thank you. Looking forward to catching up on future episodes. Cheers. And thank you very much for the 5-star review. That's it. I've got through them all this week. Thank you so much for listening. Coming this weekend, we've got the beginning of the story of Chinggis Khan. And it's the story of Chinggis Khan has become a 2-parter. Such is the... I didn't realise his childhood was as interesting as it is. And I've had a thoroughly great time writing about it and learning about it. And I'm thrilled to be able to bring you that story this coming weekend. Chinggis Khan, the early years. Until then, thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.